The following podcast is a production of Institutional Real Estate Incorporated. For the most comprehensive industry news and information, visit our website at irei.com and sign up for our free daily news alerts.
This is Mike Consul. Welcome to the program. Real estate investing in secondary markets has been one of the big talking points of the industry for at least the past few years, and for good reason. We've had a huge real estate recovery and expansion in the United States. Money has flooded into the real estate market, not just from US-based investors, but via capital flows from Asia, Europe, and even sovereign wealth funds in the Middle East. And investors in Canada alone committed close to $20 billion to US real estate during the past 12 months. Well, let's call it the 12 months ended June 2018. And that is according to real estate research firm Real Capital Analytics. The consequence has been that real estate holdings in big US cities have really been bid up to really expensive levels, which is fine if you're an institutional investor with a very long or infinite investment time horizon, but not so good if you need to reap the rewards of your investments in a more modest, say, 5 to 10 year time track. Then again, even if you've got that long time horizon, there is the ever-present need to produce vigorous returns, which becomes more difficult to achieve in the big, pricey property markets these days. Hence, the interest in secondary markets and the spillover of money from the primary to smaller markets. And as an example, according to statistics gathered by Colliers International, It reports that investors are continuing to shift capital from first-tier to second-tier markets, particularly, interestingly, among foreign investors who are feeling increasingly confident about seeking greater returns outside the top markets. Our guests on this program are part of this movement of capital from primary to secondary markets. Their names are Ryan Suela and Joe Murator, and they are co-founders of Greseda Partners based in Modesto, California. And their operating theater is California Central Valley, encompassing cities stretching from the state capital of Sacramento, south to Fresno, and several points in between. We will learn about their perspectives on the wisdom of moving capital into the secondary markets at this stage in the real estate cycle, and some of the risks associated with doing so. And with that, gentlemen, I welcome you to the program.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Joe Murator, I'm going to throw this first question to you. Talk about the less competitive nature of secondary markets and why it is advantageous. I mean, this is really what it's all about. The big markets are, the deals are hard to find, and the ones that you find are expensive. Secondary markets are less competitive. Talk about the advantages for investors at this stage.
Tier one markets are harder to wrap your brain around or get a good grip on. And in secondary markets, you have the opportunity to be a bigger fish in a smaller pond. For us, that means less competition. It means we can be more selective. There's fewer people in the $10 to $25 million price range where we primarily operate in our market. So less competition. I'd say the idea of market dominance is a wonderful thing. It's something we look for. When you're the largest player, deals come to you. It means every broker, every tenant knows who you are, has some idea of what you're doing, and it's easier to connect the puzzle pieces when you control more of them. That also leads for us to higher yields. So there's less people trying to put together the same deals we're doing, and we're able to see more of the puzzle pieces. That leads to more opportunity and more frequent opportunity and better opportunities. I'd emphasize that secondary markets are really, local information is really important in these markets. So these are markets where there's less media, there's less national players. It's a place where when we understand tenant movement, we can really capitalize on that in a way that's not publicized out to the larger investor pool. Also lets us control vendors better. It lets us manage tenant relationships more closely. So that'd be our focus in secondary markets.
And obviously, being that you have decided on this footprint, a very manageable footprint, you've got great familiarity with your markets, but that is exactly the deterrent for so many people outside of those markets. When they stop and think, It sounds like maybe this is a good opportunity, but I don't understand those markets. I don't know them well enough. I don't get the kind of reporting I get out of New York, Boston, Los Angeles, and so on. What would you tell that person, say the high net worth individual who's got money to invest, but just feels so unfamiliar with the secondary markets that are may even be producing very good returns, but they don't feel like they know exactly where to slot into it?
Well, I would tell that person to dive deep. The secondary markets are more risky than primary markets if you don't understand the markets deeply. As you touched upon, they're less analyzed, less researched. They tend to be less sophisticated, and they certainly don't have the familiarity of many larger institutional investors that are based in primary markets. So that works hard, but it pays off when you really dive deep into a secondary market and understand it well, because you're essentially de-risking without reducing returns. And so when you have that market knowledge, you have a tremendous competitive advantage, and it creates asymmetrical risk and return.
But I can tell you that I talked probably 6 weeks ago with Pat Jackson from Sabal Capital Partners, and they're very interested in secondary markets. They invest a lot in secondary markets. And I said to him, well, how many markets, secondary markets do you follow? And he said 500. And I almost choked down his answer, because I'm saying 500 markets? There's no way. I mean, how could you possibly be monitoring those markets? And he says, well, what we do is we have partners on the ground in those markets, and what they do is they bring deals to us. So what about that?
Absolutely.
You want to find a local partner, but how do you go about finding a local partner? How do you vet a local partner? Say, if you're in Boston, you're thinking Central Valley, California, or maybe the Dust Bowl of Texas. But who am I going to find on the ground? How am I going to decipher or suss out the real players?
I think real estate in many businesses are trust-based businesses. It really is a matter of getting out there. If an investor wants to get involved in a particular secondary market, trying to understand who the players in that market are, talking to brokers in that market, knowing who is active, and then it's the same sort of, wedding or marriage that occurs in any partnership, is understanding if this local partner has the same operating style, the same sophistication, that sort of thing. But it is an easy process, and I would say if they're operating in 500 markets, that they probably have been doing that vetting process for quite some time if they're effective in 500 markets.
Well, let me bring up one of the issues that has been thrown at me in the past has to do with the risk of secondary markets. And the one that's brought up oftentimes is you could find a great opportunity in the secondary market, but secondary markets tend to have maybe one or two big players. And if you've got, say, an office building, or let's say a retail center, and you've got an anchor tenant, and that tenant decides to leave or runs into financial trouble and has to pull, then you're going to have to piecemeal that space together, because there aren't other big players in the market. Or even if there is a big player in the market, they may be nicely positioned already and not looking for any kind of space. So how do you protect against that situation where a secondary market has a kind of a dearth of major players that you can really count on soaking up big swaths of space in your retail or office outlet?
The first thing I think about is what are the underlying drivers that protect that market. It depends on how isolated you are. We sit in the Central Valley of California, in the shadow of the Bay Area and Silicon Valley. And for us, and I'd also say there's 5 million people between Sacramento and Fresno, so it's not a one-horse town. there's quite a bit going on, but for us, we see population moving from the Bay Area in our direction at about 1-2% per year, and that's pretty steady. It's been steady for the last 20 years, and California Department of Finance says it's going to be that way the next 20 years, and on the ground, Intel seems to indicate that as well. So the first thing I think about in investing in a secondary market is, where is population moving? Population is trending your direction. That's a wind at your back. Secondarily, what's your proximity? What's driving that secondary market? Is it totally isolated? Is it standalone by itself, or is it in the shadow of a larger market? And there's interplay between those two dynamics. In our case, we're sort of a cost leader. It costs $1 million to buy a house in Fremont, California, and it costs $285,000 to buy one in Modesto. So in our scenario, in the mini secondary markets, workers live here and companies are over the hill, sort of. But increasingly, we see companies moving closer to their workers. We also see workers through tech and self-driving cars and A's train and other modes of transportation better able to get to the Bay Area. The last thing that's really important in secondary markets is thinking about the patterns. So secondary markets tend to rise and fall more quickly than primary markets. They have less support. So in recessions, they're going to get hit a little bit worse. So you're going to guard against that by managing your pricing going in, making sure you're at a great cost, and watching those market cycles and watching those patterns closely.
The other thing I would add also is, I would focus on secondary markets that are larger, say over a million population MSA. These type of markets tend not to be one industry or one company markets. And so I would encourage that and not buying properties that have large floor plates that need to be filled. We tend to buy multi-tenant properties. They are more management intensive, but it's a hedge against exactly what you're talking about.
Now, when we spoke before, you talked about market dominance. One of the advantages to secondary markets, you said, was that you actually have an opportunity to dominate a market. You're not going to be able to do that in a city like San Francisco or New York. But secondary markets, you can get a really commanding position. But what constitutes market dominance in markets such as the ones you guys are playing in, which Sacramento's, what, 500,000, I think? Fresno's 500,000. Modesto's about 300,000. Can you throw some numbers around as to what it would take for market dominance?
You say 500,000, you mean population?
Yeah. Is that not right? I think it's 500,000 people.
Well, it's 2.2 million in the Sacramento MSA. There's 700,000 in Stockton, 500,000 in Modesto, and 250,000 in Merced, and 1 million down in Fresno. So it adds up. To reflect on that question, though, I would say, one way to say market dominance is another way to say market concentration. But I would counter that by saying ours is a more active approach than passive. We would rather put our eggs in one basket and watch that basket closely, to use an old Warren Buffett adage. I'd also add that we're really careful about which eggs we put in that basket. And we also work to, we create a margin of safety in what we do by managing our first costs. So normally we buy things at half of replacement costs, somewhere between 40 to 60%, which can be done in our market. We buy things that you can add value quickly to, usually in the first year, either by making significant repairs, adding tenants, reducing tenant rollover, refinancing the property. We're also very careful about the tenants we put in there. We are pretty focused on medical tenants, government tenants, education, services, restaurants. I would just emphasize, though, even though we're describing a smaller geography, you pull the CoStar data, and there's $50 billion worth of retail and office assets between Sacramento and Fresno. If that property swath turns over every 7 to 10 years, there's significant deal flow. So we're selective in what we buy, but we can watch this smaller combined MSA extremely closely, day-to-day, very well.
So you indicated that basically an array of properties in a manageable footprint, and you understand that territory, you're within striking distance to all of those properties. That's all good things, but is not the risk that if a secondary market has is a one or two industry town. That's the other risk that gets brought up, is that secondary markets tend to be less diverse economically. They don't have a lot to fall back on. I'll bring up the example of Houston, Texas. Back when it was a much smaller market, back when it really was a secondary market, it was overly reliant on energy. And when energy, when the floor fell out of the energy market, Houston suffered tremendously, and there was talk about the see-through office buildings and whatnot. So what about market dominance is great until if the market is not diverse, if it is a one or two industry town, that can be problematic. Talk about protection against something like that, where you've got a market that isn't as rich in the number of industries that it really relies on.
So generally, we invest in office buildings and shopping centers, and in those, I'd say especially in shopping centers, these are hit secondarily. So in our town, manufacturing is very important, and government and medical are very important. I could see a change in manufacturing, but for us, as we think about retail, we're thinking less about traditional retail tenants and thinking more about government and education and services, businesses that are more resistant to recession. I'd say in every building we buy, we have recession in mind.
And I would also just, I can't speak to other secondary markets, but take the Central Valley. Again, like Joe mentioned, 5 million people between Sacramento and Fresno. I was looking this up. If we were an MSA, we'd be the fourth largest MSA in the country. So to take a large area like that, it's very difficult to pinpoint a particular industry that's going to move that in a meaningful way. These are the larger secondary markets are very robust, very multi industry. I certainly would be hesitant about places like, you know, Houston or the Dakotas or something like that, where they're very driven by one industry. But most of these secondary economies are very robust, multi-industry economies.
Talk about the higher yields that are possible. That's a big part of why people look at these secondary markets and sometimes go ahead and place their money there. What is possible in a secondary market? What do you guys see?
Our experience, typically when we're looking at properties, we're not moving forward on a property that isn't yielding at least a 15% IRR on a 5 to 7 year hold. And that's with no assumptions on rental growth. Our fund one that we just fully allocated has a projected IRR of 21.7%. In our markets, it's not uncommon to buy properties at a 9 cap rate or above on existing income with upside. I think the reason for that, again, is the perceived risk, but the counterpoint to that is understanding those markets very well, because a well-informed investor in those markets can still, you know, capitalize on these kind of cap rates.
You had mentioned one of the strengths of the Central Valley is growth that's happening, and you're foreseeing that growth to continue. The projection is that growth is going to continue for a good long time. What I've seen, being that our company is in the Bay Area here in the East San Francisco Bay, is that there's a lot of people getting priced out of the Bay Area proper, and they're moving further inland. So I'm imagining that that's part of the growth dynamic. But are you also seeing companies that have decided that they can do business just as well in the Central Valley and at a lower price point? What are the dynamics that you're seeing that's really driving that growth?
I'd start by saying the fastest growing counties in California are Kern County and San Joaquin County, San Joaquin County being the second fastest growing county. But in both cases, that's LA Basin and the Bay Area spilling over into the Valley. We're still a commuter-driven market. 70,000 cars leave Greater San Luis County every day and head towards the Bay Area. But we believe over time that increasingly they'll come back our way. So with self-driving cars and tech solutions and different rail solutions, more comes this way. But we're seeing a lot more freelancers and people who work for tech companies but find a way to stay in the Valley and go in fewer days, maybe once or twice a week. So we expect that to grow, and we also think that over time, more tech companies will dip their toe in this way. Although I might add, we've got the International Park of Commerce in Tracy, which is building out 20 million square feet, among the largest manufacturing or warehouse developments in the country. And we also have Google that's testing self-driving cars over in Atwater nearby us. So we are a backyard for that, for the Bay Area, and we see companies dipping their toe over.
So you guys are pointing out some things that don't exist in a lot of secondary markets that do exist in the Central Valley. You've got a lot of airports around you. You have a lot of warehouse space. You have this tremendous population and business space in the Bay Area, all of which help sustain the Central Valley and develop it. And then on top of that, I'm glad you mentioned self-driving cars, because in addition to part of the transportation revolution is self-driving cars, but not strictly self-driving cars. And I realize this is, I'm asking you guys to kind of prognosticate a little bit, and maybe this is not necessarily in your wheelhouse, but with this transportation revolution that we're seeing, there's indications that it could have a stimulating effect on secondary markets, especially secondary markets that are positioned nearby the big, the real metropolises. What about that?
So Mike, I was in San Francisco yesterday down by Ocean Beach, and there's a car parked there with all these cameras on top. And I started talking to the driver, and he said, well, he wasn't a driver, but he was testing an autonomous vehicle. And he said, you know, he works for a tech company there, but he said over the next few years, these are going to be rolling out in a big way. And that will have a big impact on our secondary market, and I think secondary markets around the country. I also think about self-driving trucks. We're positioned in between the L.A. basin and the Bay Area, and we're right about in the middle of the state, and self-driving trucks will bring a whole bunch of commerce right through our area. So you add in drones, different rail solutions, self-driving cars. The point is the world gets closer. And so for a geography like ours, which has been a little bit out of reach, but still in proximity, I think it begins to bridge the gap into making our market more viable. That said, again, we have $50 billion worth of buildings in our market. They have been standing alone for 100 years. You take standalone markets that are doing just fine for 100 years, and you add in additional opportunity, and I think that's a great place to be standing, and it's a strong wind at our back for the coming decade.
The other thing I would just add to that is I think it's safe to say that real estate values in the Bay Area are going to continue to go up. There's no pressure release valve for that. Certainly there can be softenings and whatnot, but as those real estate values continue to push up, it puts the imperative on how to remain connected to that economy while addressing that.
Yeah, the pressure relief valve.
I think you also see the move
to the Central Valley or some other area. A lot of California companies are moving to Texas, but then also just making the decision move further inland, which takes them into the Central Valley.
Yeah, I just say the Upworks and the WeWorks of the world are also mobilizing independent workers, and so there's some nexus between proximity and still being able to work through one of those platforms that's attractive to companies in the primary markets.
And you guys have also said, and I know you're of the philosophy that, look, real estate's a local business. And on the one hand, real estate is their physical structures and their position there. But not everybody treats them as a local business. That's something that you guys are doing. So even as the world is getting closer together because of that transportation revolution, as you guys were just pointing out, how that kind of shrinks the world, along with so many other technologies we've seen, like the internet. The real estate business, with all the technology we've seen being deployed, has gotten really tremendously professionalized to the extent that now big players are applying so-called big data to their investment decisions and to the management of their portfolios. And then, of course, there is that data includes market reports. And in the primary markets, you have the CBREs of the world You've got the Cushman and Wakefields and the JLLs that are producing a lot of reports. There's a lot of information about primary markets, not so much in secondary markets. So how are investors expected to deal with that dearth of information that's being produced, or not being produced, I should say, in the smaller markets?
Real estate is certainly a trust-based business. I'd say certainty of execution and speed of execution are on brokers' and tenants' minds. And so being a local business, it's the job of the operator in the secondary market to have a supply of buildings that work and have the relationships with brokers and the relationships with tenants so that all parties know this deal is going to get done. It's going to get done in a relatively easy way. And everybody's going to get paid on time, and everyone's going to be happy with the outcome. And if you're executing in a bunch of different markets, it's hard to deliver that quality of an experience like a smaller market focus group can.
What do you guys think about the fact that some of the big players are staying out of secondary markets? By big players, I'm not talking about the institutional players, because obviously they have to deploy so much capital. Secondary markets often don't make sense for them. But you have a lot of high net worth individuals and families where tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars, and they play in real estate a lot. And they look to spend on property acquisitions oftentimes, but they're not necessarily accessing those secondary markets. Let me actually flip the question around this way. What do you think would need to happen to kind of open the floodgates for secondary markets? What could happen in the way of either market information or kind of a change of attitude towards secondary markets that would really open the floodgates for this money? Obviously, we have some core, as I said at the top, we've got foreign money that is recognized in the secondary markets are worthwhile. They're pulling a lot of yield out of them, and they're not frightened away anymore, but they tend to have an awful lot of resources. What could make the difference? What could really open the floodgates?
Well, Mike, I think you really hit the nail on the head when you said change in mentality or change in attitude. I think that's the primary reservation. Investing at times can be a herd mentality and a flight to perceived safety. The secondary markets are perceived risky primarily, I believe, due to lack of knowledge about that market, lack of available data about the market. Certainly, if the level of data and knowledge were available about a secondary market as is available about a primary market, that would make people more comfortable. But I think part of how you overcome that is by having local partners. But back to the attitude, you take the Central Valley just as an example among any other secondary market. There's 6.5 million people between north of Sacramento down to Bakersfield. It's the fastest growing region in California. If it were a state, it'd be the 18th largest, almost as large as Massachusetts. And so when you talk in those kind of numbers, it doesn't sound like such a bad bet. But because there's that perception of risk because of lack of knowledge of the market, it keeps people out. And I don't know how you overcome that except through slowly changing that attitude. And frankly, I guess I would say I'm okay with that attitude continuing because it allows us to you know, monopolize on a great opportunity that people outside of our market aren't able to recognize.
Mike, I'd say deal size is a challenge too. If you're Brookfield or a larger group and you need to deploy $100 million or $200 million or $1 billion, it's pretty hard to do that in the secondary market. So a group like ours or other groups that primarily operate in secondary markets, especially in that $10 to $25 million asset size, sweet spot, find exactly that. And that small players aren't willing to go up that large, and the big players aren't willing to go down that small. So there's an answer there in the middle of the market.
So let's talk about the fund that you guys recently raised, Griseda Partners, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think I got the scenario correct. You were looking to raise $15 million, a modest fund. You got up to $12 million. There were properties that you already had targeted. You needed to strike when the iron was hot. So you went ahead and shut down the fundraise at 12 because that was enough for you to put that money into play on the properties that you wanted. And so that money has gone to work now. Is that accurate? And talk a little bit about where you're putting that money to work. Like what property?
Absolutely. So we raised $12.5 million in 3 months. Closed out the fund because we were closing on the first property, and just for cleanness of accounting, we decided we would just call it a clean break and close the fund when we're closing on our first property. We anticipated that we'd be allocating that over the next 12 months or so, but as we've continued to look for opportunities in our marketplace, we've been able to allocate it much faster than that. Primarily, we are looking at office and retail properties. Fund one will consist of three assets. All three are office properties. One's located in Modesto, one in Stockton, one in Sacramento. I'd be happy to go through, you know, in more detail about them. But I will say our continued thesis of the opportunity in our market and that niche, as Joe talked about, between the $10 to $25 million asset and our specific market knowledge, has that thesis or hypothesis has continued to play out as we've had no difficulty. Here we are arguably at a peak market, and we've been able to identify conservative, low-cost basis investments that are yielding good returns in the market.
One of the exciting things that happened during that fundraise, my understanding, is that the University Endowment from Notre Dame contacted you guys. And although they didn't actually invest in the fund, at least not to date they haven't, you must have been pleased to have an institutional investor like a university endowment from Notre Dame contacting you and asking some questions.
Yeah, when we put that Reg D out, we started to get quite a few calls. So it opened up a whole new world for us.
Yeah, and I would add our investor base primarily has been local high net worth or regional high net worth families or institutions. And as we broaden our scope, we do find that we're getting more interest from outside the area. And not something that we anticipated going into it, but something that we're continuing to explore and take advantage of.
But almost everything we've done is word of mouth. So you do well for one investor, and they tell friends and family, and it sort of blossoms from there.
Yeah, and then obviously, like with any fund, if it performs well, you've got repeat clients, and then expanding beyond that. And before we get to that, because I know you guys have a second fund in mind, I did want to point out that one of the other big distinctions between the primary and secondary markets is you have big players in the primary markets with a lot of dry powder sitting around. They want that money invested, but the managers, their investment managers, obviously don't want to capriciously be investing in properties that don't really pass muster. They don't pencil the way they want them to. The cap rates are not what they want them to be. So there's a lot of money sitting on the sidelines. Much less so, I would imagine, in the secondary markets. You guys knew exactly where you wanted to place that money. Granted, it wasn't, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars, but at the same time, it sounds like the secondary markets, there's a lot more fluidity for that capital.
We see a lot of dry powder. We raised $12 million in 3 months, and we're looking forward to raising Fund 2. It seems like people are nervous about the markets. They were nervous about the economy for a while. Now it seems like people are a little more comfortable. But, you know, 11 years into this up part of the cycle, people are wondering when the shoe will drop. There's a little bit of a flight to quality. I'm not sure that's the right phrase. But they know us. They can see us. They can come to our office. They can see the buildings that they are invested in. They can go, you know, physically be a part of those. And that's not something you're going to get with a mutual fund or a bond fund. So I think that's attractive to people as well. Plus, you know, 15% to 30% returns is a great thing compared to what people are expecting in the market. So if they can experience the quality of knowing the managers and seeing the assets and outstanding returns with a track record, that's served us well. So we're looking forward to Fund 2, and it's been a pleasure to go through Fund 1 and now be almost fully invested with it.
Let's talk about Fund 2. What is the fundraise target, and what is the investment strategy?
The fundraise target is $25 million, and we think we'll buy about $65 million worth of buildings for that, $65 million worth of buildings with that from Sacramento to Fresno. And we see additional opportunity in Sacramento. We're currently buying a building in South Natomas. We really like that submarket. And we see other opportunities within that submarket right on the edge of downtown where it offers a value over what's happening downtown. We're also buying a building in Stockton and see more opportunity there, and are exploring things in Fresno as well. So we see plenty of opportunity, and the more active we are, the more opportunity is presented to us.
To touch on the investment strategy too, we started in the downturn, our company, and we're very downturn focused. And I think Joe mentioned flight to safety, and you could kind of say that, because it tends to be in what we're looking for is a flight to safety against a downturn. And the way we do that is by buying well below replacement costs, buying cash flowing properties that may have some value add component, but generally are not extremely value add. And we're not banking on appreciation, you know, market appreciation to give us our yield. We're banking on cash flow and modest increase in rental rates over time.
Okay, so you build in the downside protection there. And then when it comes to property types, it sounds like you have retail and office. Are those the two property types that you guys feel most conversant with? Is that where you plan to invest the money, or are you thinking also in terms of some other property types? Or do you want to just kind of stick with your knitting to pull Warren Buffett back into the conversation and say, look, our real house is retail and office, and we can do just fine with that? Or do you have broader aspirations in terms of property types?
Yeah, we primarily buy office and retail because those are the asset classes that we feel are undervalued. Industrial and multifamily, certainly in our markets and I think throughout the country, are exhibiting every indication of peak pricing. So we have purchased industrial, we've purchased multifamily, and we would certainly do that again, but I think we need to see adjustment in pricing expectations in those asset classes before we dive in, given where we are in the market cycle.
We're geography focused more than asset type focused. We've owned industrial buildings, some large ones. We've owned multifamily. But the biggest opportunities right now are in office and retail. Both of those are more expert zones. They're a little bit harder to understand. They're a little bit, they're certainly less commoditized. So that's where we see the opportunity to offer the returns that we'd like to offer.
So what is the long game at Griseda Partners? You've got Fund 1 going to work right now. You're planning Fund 2. I suspect you may have Fund 3 in mind as well. As you look down the road, we talk to big players in big markets all the time, and we see what's possible. We see them just explode in size when they do well. You're a smaller player in a smaller market, so what do you think is possible there?
Is Ryan and my partnership. We've been good friends since third grade, and we've been in business for 15 years, 10 years in this current setting, current business. But I think that's what drives, that's the engine that drives our business. There's a competition there. There's a camaraderie there. There's a trust there. We bought $70 million worth of buildings together, and there's a strength that works well together, but it's a little bit different from each side, and that makes what we do work really well. The plan would be to build additional funds, and as we see opportunity, keep raising money and doing that. We're both about 40, and I see a 20 or 30 year runway. This is the job I've dreamed of doing and love doing, and I can't see doing anything else with my life. So I think Ryan would feel the same way, but I expect in the next 20 or 30 years doing larger versions of this. But there's certainly a strong runway in our current geography to keep doing what we're doing.
And Mike, you talked a little bit in our past conversations about the research out there that, you know, well establishes returns declining over successive funds. And, you know, we take that as a personal challenge. One of our secret sauce is that Joe and I are both very competitive people, and we each work hard to outdo the other when it comes to finding and executing on the best investments. And so that's a built-in hedge against that.
So you guys get together, you stress test things. One of you finds a deal, maybe brings it in the door, and the other one says, "Not so fast, Junior. What about this? What about that?" I mean, how much?
It's exactly like that.
Is it?
It's one brings a particular deal in, the other pokes holes in it. One has certain assumptions that they're more conservative on or more aggressive on. The other has the opposite. There's a lot of interplay there, and we kind of joke around if we both agree on a deal's merits and on the underwriting, then it's a pretty good thing to bet on.
we always deliver a better product as a team. If one person comes in the door with an idea of how this thing should be, and the other person says, "Okay, I get that, but what about this and this and this and this?" And at the end, by the time we put in that offer or move to the next level or work with that tenant, it's tweaked. It's tweaked another 15 or 20%, and it's always better. So I'm confident that's a key part of our secret sauce. I look at some of these larger companies. I look at Blackstone and Carlyle and Brookfield, at least in its current configuration. Hines and Shorenstein, some of these have become second generation now, but most of these companies started 30, 35 years ago with a couple of people who had a vision and started really working hard. And I don't know what that means for us, but we are committed to seeing where this takes us, and it's exciting to work at it together. We've been friends for 35 years.
Final question. As the markets currently stand that you're working, obviously, there's some macroeconomic dynamics that are in your favor, but if you look at the markets as they currently stand, Sacramento to Fresno, how much money could be successfully placed in high-performance real estate to a great effect right now? If you were given a windfall of money to work with, how many dollars do you think you could place right now in real estate without making those compromises, without becoming undisciplined about where you're committing it?
Well, I think as Joe touched on, there's $50 billion of commercial real estate in the Central Valley. So if we are focused on buying the best 10% of that, say that's $5 billion in commercial real estate. So, I mean, I think there's every property cycles over time. And so this is a long game. This isn't a short game, but we're definitely continuing to focus on buying the best assets in the marketplace as they become available. And as they're priced well.
It's a 5 to 10 year plan, but I look at the largest movers in the Sacramento market in the last couple of years, and a couple of groups have spent $100 to $200 million. And to be a dominant player in Sacramento, that's where you need to be. Personally, we bought $50 million worth of assets in Modesto, in Greater Modesto, in the last 2 or 3 years, and that's allowed us to be the dominant player in this market. But as we move to those markets, first it's going to look like being dominant as a submarket and then sort of radiating out from there. And Fresno, there's a big opportunity there. And that's going to be a step we're going to explore in the next year or so.
And the Central Valley is only slightly smaller than the entire San Francisco Bay Area. That San Francisco Bay Area is 7.5 million people, Central Valley 6.5 million people. So if a fund operator or an investment manager said, "We're going to spend all our time investing in the San Francisco Bay Area," I think most people would say, say there's a lot of runway there, and people are just surprised that there's a similar runway in an area like the Central Valley.
And certainly the economies are different. There's a $500 billion economy over in the East Bay Area, and there's a $50 billion economy in Sacramento-Stockton region. But the asset values reflect that, and the yield opportunity is greater. So the money has a longer runway, and we're able to buy and do more with it over on this side of the hill.
Our guests have been Ryan Suela and Joe Muratore. They are co-founders and partners at Crescita Partners, based in Modesto, and obviously enthusiastic proponents of investing in secondary market real estate. Gentlemen, congratulations on the first fund. Good luck with the second fund, and thank you for taking the time and walking us through some of the finer points of operating in the secondary market.
Thank you much, Mike.